All right, so last week, you'll recall, we studied Judges 18 and 19. This is exciting, because this is our second-to-last class. Next week is the big hoorah. And you'll recall that last week, we talked about, we finished the first section of the end of Judges, which was the religious corruption that prevailed in the land of Israel during that time. That encompassed chapters 17 and 18. And then we started the last section of Judges, which is the last three chapters, chapters 19 through 21. And we made it all the way up to verse 21 of chapter 19. And you'll remember that in chapter 19, we are introduced to an unnamed Levite whose concubine had left him and returned home to Bethlehem, to her father's house where she was from, that after a period of time, the Levite went to speak kindly to her, that he said that was, the text says that was his intention, and get her to return with him to their home. And we find in chapter 19, in verse 22, the Levite, his concubine, a servant of theirs, in a host's house in the land or in the town of Gibeah. So you remember that Gibeah is a town in Benjamin, okay? And it's actually an Ephraimite who was sojourning in Benjamin that actually was the one who welcomed them into his home. And so that's where the scene picks up in chapter 19 and verse 22. I'll just say right off the bat, what we're talking about tonight, there's not a lot of bright spots. In fact, I don't even know if there is one bright spot in the entire text. I just want to remind y'all that in these chapters especially, but really throughout much of Judges, is God's commentary on life when people do what's right in their own eyes. So that's what we're seeing play out here in chapters 19, 20, and 21. That's what we saw play out in chapters 17 and 18 with the idol worship that was going on in Micah's house, and then that affected the tribe of Dan. And it's unfortunately the scene that plays out still today in parts of our country and in parts of the world where people have no moral compass, they have no respect or honor for God. They're just doing what's right in their eyes. And so, sadly, we're going to see these terrible events take place at the end of chapter 19, and unfortunately, it's not the last time in the history of people that such outrageous events have happened. So with that, we're going to pick up in verse 22. So the Levite and his Ephraimite host were having a good time, were making their hearts merry, when men from the city called worthless fellows, or the NET calls them good-for-nothings, come to their house and repeatedly beat on the door. They demand that the old man, who was the host, send out the Levite so that they could have sex with him, which was, of course, explicitly condemned in verses like Leviticus 18, 22. Again, I can't emphasize enough that this is an Israelite city, and this is Israelites in Gibeah, Benjaminites, perpetrating atrocities against a fellow Israelite, a Levite, and eventually against his concubine, as we'll come to see the scene unfold. The old man who was their host refuses and says, don't do this wicked thing, or don't do such a disgraceful thing. In an attempt to appease these rapists, he offers his daughter and the Levite's concubine, saying, violate them and do with them what seems good to you. Literally, in the Hebrew, it could be translated, do to them that which is good in your eyes. And what does that sound familiar? What we've been talking about, right? Everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. So, what account, other Old Testament account that we briefly referenced last week, does this have a striking similarity to? That's right, Sodom and Gomorrah, which is in Genesis chapter 19. And so far, what have you seen that's a parallel to what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah?
Comes them in and for the purpose of protecting them from known hazards, I think. And then the men of the city come, demand to have relations. Yeah. There's a battle over that.
That's right. So they express their intent to want to have these perverse sexual relations with the angelic messengers in Genesis chapter 19, in this case, with the Levite, who is sojourning here in Gibeah. And even the offer of this Ephraimite host mirrors that of Lot. So as beyond our comprehension as Lot's offer was, similarly here with this Levite's offer for them to have his daughter and the concubine in place of the Levite. So It's not certain if all the men of the city are in view here or just a group of troublemakers. The wording here in the Hebrew, the words are in apposition. That is to say that the last phrase, good for nothings or worthless fellows, specifies what kind of men they were. However, as we come to see things unfold, the Benjamites do not take a stand against these perpetrators in Gibeah. And that's why there's a civil war in the next chapter. So even if there were certain individuals in Gibeah who are not directly involved in this incident, that they didn't take a stand against it, when it was called out, they're condemned just the same. Again, the actions of the host nearly identical to those of Lot. It appears that the host's honor was at stake, not necessarily justice or morality. So from his perspective, and I'm not trying to be too graphic here, heterosexual rape was preferable to that being homosexual, and that he believed physical resistance was futile. You can just imagine being in a city like this, knowing the character of the people that were surrounding you, and being in that position and the kind of stress and terrible position he was in. I don't condone in any way his offer of his daughter and a concubine, but I just can't imagine what a position that was to be in. I made this point last week that at this time there was no 911, you know, that Ephraimite couldn't run to the house and call the cops and have them come solve it. He was on his own. There was no one coming here to help him, and so, you know, he does what he does. The men of Gibeah do not accept the man's offer, so the Levite, it's on him, in an attempt to save himself, apparently, grabs his concubine and forces her to go outside with the men. Sadly, she's sexually abused and humiliated all night and is barely able to return to the house where her husband was staying before collapsing at the door. It doesn't just say that they raped her. It also says that they abused her, and that language here has a nuance of shameful abuse of another. So it's not that they were just gratified by this devious sexual desire that they had, but also in the shameful experience of the woman, which just makes it even more terrible than it already was. I'm going to pause here and see if anybody has a comment or question before we go on and pick up in verse 27. Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that this story and the story of Lot, that apparently the sodomy and pedestry was rather commonplace, particularly among heathen nations. And we think, I mean, it's an aberration, and we are shocked when we find out about it in our generation, but it was something that went on, you know, a lot back then.
Right, that's a good point, yeah.
And we'll get to this point, and I want to make it several times. What the narrator here is attempting to do, I think, is make a point that the Benjaminites, who are Israelites, have become just like the Canaanites. That with what ensues with the civil war and all the Israelites gathering against them and battling against them, killing them and almost wiping out the entire tribe, that's almost exactly what they were commanded to do against the Amorites, the Ammonites, the Jebusites. But now they're doing it against their own brethren. So when we talk about the downward spiral of Judges, this is rock bottom. This is the most debased that the people get, I think, in the narration of Judges. But I appreciate your point, Wayne. Thank you that it was sadly common in that era, too. Okay, what else? All right, so as atrocious as that was, the next morning, the Levite begins to depart from Gibeah and notices his concubine lying there at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And in the only recorded words we have between him and this woman, this young girl, he tells her, get up, let us be going. Or the NET translates it, get up, let's leave. Almost goes without saying how incredibly calloused his actions are here. So these three activities where he got up, opened the doors, and went out, you might expect him to be motivated to go looking for her, checking on her welfare. Instead, his stated intention in the text is to go on his way. Nearly trips over the woman, appears maybe not to even expected to find her at all. So I don't have a high opinion, to put it nicely, of this Levite individual, this Levite man, based on the way that he acts here and what he's going to come to do in a moment. So after telling her to get up, she doesn't respond. And this is where, to me, the text is not clear when she passed away. I'll just leave it for your own consideration. So in chapter 20, when there's this great assembly in Mizpah, he's going to claim that they murdered her, that they were the ones who killed her. And so the implication is that she was dead when he found her. However, to my reading, the narrator leaves open the possibility that she hadn't yet died by that point, because he loads her body onto a donkey, returns to his house, and then in an attempt to provoke a reaction amongst the Israelites, which it does, he dismembers her and sends her body parts throughout Egypt. There's a parallel to this in 1 Samuel chapter 11, when Saul, not with a person, but with a yoke of oxen, divided them up and sent the pieces throughout Israel, calling them to arms against the Ammonites there in 1 Samuel chapter 11. But besides that, there's really no parallel in the biblical text to what this Levite does. So he wanted everybody to know about this abomination that had taken place, and he felt like this was the way to raise awareness of this event. What's not explicitly stated is that with these messages, for lack of a better word, were also sent messengers. So receiving something like that out of context, you wouldn't know what to make of it. So it's likely there were messengers accompanying the body parts that explained how they arrived there. Israelites are floored by this, say nothing this bad has happened since the Israelites had left Egypt. Chapter ends with them saying, consider it, take counsel, and speak. Or the NIV translates it this way, just imagine, we must do something, so speak up. The stage is set for the ensuing battle to punish the men of Gibeon. In fact, all of the Benjaminites for these atrocities. Let me pause here and just see if anybody has a comment or question about those remaining verses here in chapter 19. I think that's about as unpleasant as it gets, frankly, in the book of Judges. And one of those things that whenever I signed up to teach the class and then read through Judges, I always thought, oh boy, that's going to be a tough one. And it's really difficult to put ourselves in the situation that they found themselves in here. And it's almost beyond explanation. In fact, Daniel Beeman and I were talking after class last week, and I think he made the point, correct me if I'm misstating it, but some things are just beyond explanation. And so we might try and understand and rationalize and explain it away. Some things are just so evil that we can't understand or explain it. And I think that this is definitely in that category. But I want you to remember that God has recorded these events for a reason. We respond with repugnance and disbelief at this wanton regard for human life. It's important to note that our Father is also repulsed by what happened here. Just as he was repulsed by the idolatry that was taking place in chapter 17 and 18, and just like he's repulsed by a lot of the idolatry and unfaithfulness that takes place in the book of Judges. The only other time I know of that this event in Gibeah is mentioned is actually in Hosea, say at 9 and 10 in verses 9 of each of those chapters, where during Hosea's prophesying, which I think was in the time of Jeroboam, more or less, Israel then is compared to having reached a low like that time of Gibeah. So just like Sodom and Gomorrah was a low for people, humanity, the events here in Gibeah represent a new low for the Israelites that's later referenced in their history. So I'm going to stop there, and before we go into chapter 20, see what y'all have to say. Yes, sir.
A lot more that's happening here than the assault of the concubine. There's a lot more sin involved, just like there was in Sodom and Gomorrah and other times. And one of the ones we don't often think about in terms of sin is hospitality or lack thereof. You know, we don't think about it as much today because if you're on the road going somewhere and you want to stop and sleep, what do? Well, most people get a hotel, but a lot of people could couch surf, all kinds of things. I mean, it's convenient, it's easy. Back then, that didn't exist. And if you're traveling somewhere, you didn't have a card that you could rent a car with or whatever, you carried money on your person. And therefore, you were a target for somebody who could lie in wait for you. you're always at risk of being robbed, and the risk could come up and go down depending on where you're at and if you were with other people and so on and so forth. So the idea of hospitality in that context, even more so than today, is super critical because people depended on it. And I just point out there's so much more that happened in this context than just this event. As awful and depraved and as evil and as vile as it was, the behavior of those men were, and the behavior of those who endorsed it and refused to do anything about it, it didn't start with that. And we ought to keep that in mind.
Yeah, great point. Thank you. What else?
Corey.
When he found him there, I think it already went through his mind that you can't stay out here. You know, to live in that environment where you know there's danger and that this could happen, let's get you in my house. Hopefully nobody sees you. Come with me. But apparently they did, right? The rumor was already out. There's travelers. But that was the environment. That was the Sodom and Gomorrah type place that he was living in, trying to protect, trying to help, trying to... And so, unfortunately, it was a part of the culture. And like you said, the Benjamites, the heathen, they were a heathen nation at that time, a heathen tribe, heathen, like, anything goes. I mean, that's how far it had gone. And he knew.
You're right.
All right. Thank y'all. So, that happened. These terrible events in Gibeah, or at least what's initially known about them, definitely have an intended effect by the Levite, that is, and what he did with his concubine's body. Israelites assemble as one man or together to the Lord at Mizpah. Mizpah itself is also located in Benjamin. So all of Israel is coming together on Benjamin's doorstep. Not at Gibeah yet, but at Mizpah. And there collected are 400,000 soldiers of non-Benjaminite Israelites with the chiefs of every tribe. We also come to learn that there was another group of folks who didn't show up here from chapter 21, and that was residents of Jabesh-Gilead. And that'll play into next week's class. So just remember that. Put a bookmark in that for next week. So at this assembly, the Israelites demand from the Levite, explain how this wicked thing happened. So at this gathering, we don't yet know, but in chapter 21, it's revealed that they made two oaths, which will come into play in the next chapter, the last chapter in Judges. The first being that they resolved not to let any of their daughters marry a Benjaminite. And also, they vowed to execute any Israelite who did not join this assembly at Mizpah. This figure, 400,000, most likely is a comparison with the census back in Numbers chapter 26, and suggesting that by this point, the population of Israel had fallen by about a third since the end of the wilderness wanderings. So here we have the whole assembly gathered with the chiefs, and they bring forward as witness the Levite, asks for his testimony, and he tells a version of the events from the previous chapter. I hinted at this last week, but did you notice any differences in what actually happened in Gibeah and what he says or doesn't say happened there? It's okay, it's not. It's kind of specific.
He doesn't mention that he gave his concubine in verse 5, so they ravished
him. Right, exactly right.
So, if you haven't figured this out yet in life, when someone's telling their version of events, very often they're telling a story to present themselves in a better light than the truth would actually shine on them. Notably, he doesn't discuss why he was on the journey in the first place, that his concubine had left him. Further, he says the men of Gibeah intended to kill him. Well, their initial request was to have intercourse with him, as far as we know. And then, as David mentioned, he doesn't mention his own role in forcing the young woman out of the house to join these depraved men in order to spare his own life. So again, the adage, there are two sides to every story, is still true. He explains to them that he took his... Oh, sorry, Caitlin, go ahead.
The man that took them in and Lot are surrounded by these, you know, terrible places, but it seems they still had some good in them, right? Like, they still cared about hospitality. But then they still do what's right in their own eyes. So they have this hospitality, but then they think, like you said, it's better to give these women than these men. And so, and this guy too, he gave his concubine to them. And so just those, they, some of them still clearly had some good in their heart, but they rationalized and were desensitized. And you just, we still do that. Like throughout the scriptures, that's a common theme of people giving what is not theirs to give, starting with Eve. She gave the fruit to her husband with her. She had no right to do that. She rationalized. Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham, no right to do that, etc. throughout the scriptures. And, I mean, that still happens today where we rationalize and we think, well, I think this is better, but you didn't turn to the scriptures and see what God said instead.
Very well said. Thank you.
Let's see. Where was I? All right. So explain why he took the actions he did, which was to raise awareness of this abomination and outrage in Israel. And he concludes his speech by requesting that the Israelites resolve right here and now how they're going to handle this atrocity. NET translates verse 7 this way, all you Israelites, make a decision here. So he's saying this speech to drum up support and demanding action. I'll just say this briefly and leave it for you to think about. Not much is revealed about his intentions or motivation in this speech. To me, it's possible that he desired justice to be done against the men of Gibeah for what they attempted to do to him and ended up doing against his wife, concubine. I also entertain the possibility that he was personally offended by their behavior and just wanted to see the perpetrators punished. We may never know. Hopefully, after this point, he turned his life over fully to serving the Lord after these terrible events. That brings us down to verse 8. Now having the testimony of this witness, the Israelites are united. I forgot to mention this, but the events in Gibeah transpire here in Benjamin. And at the beginning of chapter 20, it says that all the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba, and even from the land of Gilead, which is over here, are called together at this assembly. And remember, we just talked about Dan last week because that's where the Danites went to settle. They conquered that city Laish and then took with them the idols from Micah's house. And so that phrase from Dan to Beersheba encompasses all of Israel. So all the Israelites united by this atrocity in Gibeah are motivated to rectify this great evil. They resolve to move on Gibeah to repay them for this outrage that they've committed. And according to verse 11, they arrive on Gibeah's doorstep. They first send messengers, as I'm sure you noticed, throughout Benjamin. Remember, this is where Gibeah is located, asking, how could such a wicked thing take place? And what demand do they make of the Benjaminites? That's right. Yeah. So send out the perpetrators of this event. So their request was that they would bind and hand over those responsible for punishment, which would have avoided a war and would have demonstrated that the Benjaminites were in agreement with the other tribes. Is that what happened? No. The whole tribe, at least the greater part, stood by and are implicated now in the crimes of Gibeah. Their stated purpose, the Israelites' purpose, is to purge the evil from Israel. And that phrase we've read a lot in the book of Deuteronomy appears regularly there, referring to capital punishment of serious infractions of God's law. So in response to this, the fact that the Israelite army is on their doorstep and they're unwilling to hand over the perpetrators, the Benjaminites muster their forces. So we said that the Israelites have 400,000 gathered. How many do the Benjaminites muster? About. What? 26,700. Just about 26,000, 27,000. So puts the odds at about 15 to 1. So you think reading that, it's like it's going to be pretty cut and dry, taken care of pretty quickly, as we're going to come to see, that is not the case. There are a few things noted about the Benjaminite soldiers in particular. First of all, we're told that there were 700 elite members of their force who could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Or as the NET translates it, each one could sling a stone and hit even the smallest target. We'll get to that in a little bit. So I've read that back during this time, a skillful stone slinger warrior like this could sling a stone as far as 1,000 feet. But can you imagine going out to battle against people and them being so accurate that all they had to do was hit you in the head or another part of your body and impale you, and then that was it? That's what we're going to come to see. So that's what the narrator's setting up, is that the Benjaminites are not wusses. They're serious soldiers, and they're going to have a definite damaging effect on the Israelite forces. So this just are some photos. I may be a little off kilter again tonight. That's okay. We'll get through it. So here's Gibeah. Remember, the Israelites first assemble at Mizpah. And to look at it from a different point of view, remember that the travelers came from Jebus, Jerusalem, which is here, up to Gibeah, where the atrocities took place, and the Israelite army starts out at Mizpah. That's where they're plotting. And then these are sling stones from Dothan. And according to the caption or the footnote of this slide, contrary to popular perception, sling stones were not small, but were around the size of a baseball or a fist. So again, that's what the Israelites are going out in battle against in warfare at this time. We're also told that they were left-handed, so they were skilled for battle and that they were right-hand bound. And this is going to be reaching back a little bit, but does anybody remember the judge who was left-handed, was also a Benjaminite, somebody that's not Wyatt? No, Wyatt, you can answer. Who was it?
Yeah, that's right, Ehud. So
all the way back in Judges chapter 3, remember Ehud was the one that hid the dagger and approached Eglon in secret and ran him through. He was a Benjaminite soldier who was also right-hand bound. So these soldiers were ambidextrous in battle and skillful, to say the least. That brings us down to through verse 17. So I'll pause here and see what y'all have to say about any of these verses so far. All right, so the stage is set. And at Bethel, the Israelites inquire of God which tribe should lead the effort against Benjamin. And what response are they given? They're told Judah should lead. And this is also reaching back pretty far. But does that remind anybody of anything that we've read, like in the first chapter? So again, a parallel that the narrator's trying to make here is that all the way back in chapter 1, when the Israelites were doing battle against the Canaanites, they wanted direction from God. Who's going to lead this effort? And God said, Judah shall lead. Here in chapter 20, it's battle again, but it's not against Canaanites. It's against their fellow Israelites. And again, Judah is meant to take the lead. The enemy is not Canaanites now, but Israelites. So the Israelites, led by Judah, do battle against the Benjaminites at Gibeah on the first day. Remember, the odds are 15-1. But even with that advantage, the Israelite forces suffer grave losses. On this occasion, it's 22,000 of their soldiers. At this point, there's no mention of Benjaminite losses. At this point, the Israelites regroup. They took courage or took heart, prepare for battle on the second day, the same way as the first. However, it's noted here that the Israelites wept before the Lord until the evening, and this time inquired of God, saying, shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And how does God respond to this inquiry? Yep, go up against them, or the NET says, attack them. So now we have the second day of battle, where there are more significant losses on the Israelites' part, 18,000 this time. So that means 18,000, 22,000, 40,000 lost. That's a tenth of their forces that are lost in these 2 days of battle against the Benjaminites. This is my speculation, so take it for what it's worth. Sometimes we need to be brought low in order to wholly lean on God and recognize our dependence on Him. That may be the reason why they suffered such staggering losses after these first 2 days of battle, especially because the next time that they appeal to God, they do it differently than the first 2 times, but we don't know for sure. So again, at Bethel, after these great losses on their part, all the people of Israel, the whole army, weep before the Lord, they fast all day, they offer burnt offerings, peace offerings, and now they inquire of the Lord, saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And in response to this inquiry, the Lord says, attack, for tomorrow I will hand them over to you. And kind of in the middle of the story, the narrator offers a parenthetical statement, which lends credibility to the efforts that they were undertaking. He lets us know that at this time, the ark was in Bethel, and that Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, who we mentioned briefly last week, was serving the Lord in those days in verse 28. So to my reading, this indicates the Israelites were using the appropriate channel and means of appealing to God. In other words, not doing what was right in their own eyes. And by the way, the actions that they were undertaking on this occasion, the third time, the Israelites have not often been described as doing this in the book of Judges. Weeping, fasting, offering sacrifices to God. So to me, it's a genuine appeal to him for help and guidance. So this time they're going to change their strategy a bit, and they're going to employ a new tactic, that being that of the ambush. Note that verses 33 through the first part of 36 is kind of like the battle summary. Sorry, this is what happened in summary. And then the rest of the chapter, the second part of verse 36 down through the end, just gives us more detail about exactly how it all unfolded. So they set an ambush around Gibeah while also preparing for battle, like in the previous days. And as before, these Benjaminite soldiers exit their stronghold in Gibeah to attack the Israelites, successfully kill some of them, and they believe that yet again they've achieved the battle advantage. So the forces prepare to wipe out the Israelite army with this effort on this day. However, that's not at all how it happens, as we come to find out. So as it depicts here, the forces that were lying in ambush outside of Gibeah, when the Benjaminite soldiers left the city to battle the Israelites, what did that force do inside the city? They put it to the sword, and then they had a signal that they had arranged, that being a smoke signal. So they set the city on fire, and the two opposing groups reacted, as you can imagine, differently to that signal. Benjaminites were caught unawares, realized that they had been bested in battle, and the Israelites took heart and knew that Gibeah had been conquered, and now they could go on to attack their forces. Do you note, too, that the text says that it was the Lord who defeated Benjamin on that day? On this occasion, they suffered heavy losses. We're told 25,100 men, all these warriors of the tribe of Benjamin. And remembering that they started with around 27,000 soldiers, they've lost almost 95% of their fighting forces. But the Israelites didn't just stop there, because there's a small contingent of Benjaminites that flee to a place called the Rock of Rimmon, which we'll see a slide of in just a second. But even with that, what further steps did the Israelite soldiers take against the tribe of Benjamin? Did they call it quits after that battle? According to verse 48? No. So again, they're striking other inhabitants of Benjamin with a sword, putting them to death. I would take that to mean women and children, and also cattle, livestock in the towns, and burning the towns of Benjamin. Again, very similar to what they were commanded to do against the Canaanites. Now they're doing against their fellow Israelites. This is just a picture of caves. So the Hebrew word Rimmon means pomegranate. And so they think that since these caves look like an open pomegranate, that's what they would have looked like where these Benjaminites fled to. And we're going to learn in the next chapter, in chapter 21 and verse 13, that these 600, I think it is, Benjaminite survivors are offered peace. And also chapter 21 is really just telling us the end of the story of Benjamin, how it is that they weren't snuffed out in the end, and how wives were provided for them. All this reminds me, as it may remind you, of what Jesus said in Mark 3, verse 24. Here, he had been accused of using the devil's power to cast out demons, but in his defense states a general truth to build his case about that being absolutely false. And in Mark 3 and verse 24, Jesus says, if a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. So again, to make the point, this downward spiral of Israel, we see now them divided against themselves and one tribe, at least, almost being completely wiped out because of the heinous acts in Gibeah. The Israelites had been charged, and I made this point several times, with conquering the land of Canaan in order to dispense justice to the Canaanites, but also as a fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. All the way back to Genesis 15 and verse 13, God told Abraham, your descendants are going to be strangers in the land of Israel, Egypt, for 400 years. And in verse 16, he says, and they shall come back here, that being the land of Canaan, in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So at that time in Genesis, God was not yet ready to punish the Canaanites for their wickedness. But by the time Joshua and Judges rolled around, it was time. And that's what Israel was meant to do. And not only hadn't they done that, but the wickedness and unfaithfulness in Israel had actually caused them to turn in on themselves, to be a kingdom divided against itself, which, as we'll come to see in Israel's history, did not stand. We also see in this whole narrative how serious God is in demanding that his people eradicate sin from their lives, do we not? It's no wonder that his son later said, if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. Had this people taken his law and covenant seriously, this whole mess could have been avoided. Like the Israelites, if we fail to fully eradicate sin from our lives and manage our temptations, we'll end up in a similar downward spiral, just like they did. We have just a couple minutes left. I just want to say something briefly. You know, at the point that the Benjaminites were confronted with the truth about what happened at Gibeah and they had the opportunity to turn over the perpetrators and avoid further bloodshed and the civil war that ensued, that was the best option for them. And I think in our lives, often, we're confronted with that choice. It's like the moment of truth where, okay, I know I'm wrong and I need to fess up to it now and do something about it now, but our pride or ego or whatever keeps us from doing it. And what happened to the Benjaminites happens to us too. We just bring more sorrow and damage on ourselves and on other people. So the takeaway from there is that when we find ourselves in that position where we're confronted with the truth and challenged to make it right, face the consequences, let's do it, because what comes after that if we refuse to do that is much worse than whatever we would have suffered. All right, so that's going to bring me to our takeaway, but I'm going to pause here and see what comments or questions y'all have before I get to this. We're going to have a final exam next week. It's going to be specific questions about each judge. I'm going to call out. I've been meaning to tell you all this, that we worshiped with a brother in San Antonio, Jim Shelburne. When he would teach class, if you were making eye contact with him and he asked a question, he would call you by name. And so it was better just like at the beginning of class to raise your hand and answer a question, because then his eyes wouldn't like find you at all for the rest of the class. So I'm not going to resort to that in this class, but maybe in the future. So just kidding. This civil war began because of the wicked actions of a few men in one town and was made much worse by their brothers' unwillingness to stand up to them for their evil deeds. So I've kind of made this point, but I'll make it more pointedly here. For us to avoid a similar firestorm in our lives, let's do two things. Make sure that in all of our relationships, we're pursuing peace and unity in our families, in our work relationships, in our church relationships, and community relationships, but also that when the time comes for us to take a stand against evil, we have the courage to do that, even when it hits close to home for us, as it did for the Benjaminites. So that's all I have to say, and I think that brings us to the end of our class. So we'll stop there. Thank you all.